From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the travel ban is back. Senate Republicans struggle to undo Obamacare, and Donald Trump brings his tweet attacks to a new low.
He appears to have a fragile, impetuous, childlike ego that we've seen over and over again, especially with women. It's like he can't take it.
I think the American people elected somebody who's tough, who's smart, and who's a fighter, and that's Donald Trump. And I don't think that it's a surprise to anybody that he fights fire with fire.
It's all part of our week in review. Also today, a budget impasse in Maine could lead to a government shutdown. Plus, why the 1812 Overture, commemorating Napoleon's retreat from Russia, became synonymous with American independence. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and happy Friday, everybody. It's been a long, busy week in the news, so let's jump right into our week in review, beginning with the stalled Republican effort to repeal and replace Obamacare. Senate leader Mitch McConnell was unable to assemble the votes for a plan that would dramatically scale back Medicaid, leave 22 million uninsured, and deliver a huge tax cut to wealthy Americans. So he says he'll try again after the 4th of July recess, but his challenge remains. Here's Republican Maine Senator Susan Collins, who says she has fundamental problems with the Republican bill.
It's difficult for me to see how any tinkering is going to satisfy my fundamental and deep concerns about the impact of the bill.
The Democrats, who it has to be said don't have a plan of their own to fix Obamacare, remain unanimous in their opposition to the Republican plan. Here's Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey earlier this week.
The legislation that the Republicans are proposing is of the rich, for the rich, and by the rich to ensure that they get a huge tax break while the health care for ordinary families in our country is slashed.
Meanwhile, the very serious debate about how to rewrite 15% of the national economy was overwhelmed by a Trump tweet attack on Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough of MSNBC, which scores of Democrats and Republicans condemned as vile, sexist, and beneath the dignity of the presidency. Here's Mika Brzezinski.
The president's tweets, whether they're personally aimed at me or aimed at me in some way, that doesn't bother me one bit. It does worry me about the country. He appears to have a fragile, impetuous, childlike ego that we've seen over and over again, especially with women. It's like he can't take it.
Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine spoke for many when she tweeted about the president, "This has to stop." Well, joining us now are John Carroll, professor of communication at Boston University and a senior news analyst for WBUR. John Carroll, great to see you.
Good to be here.
And Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute of Boston. Always great to see you as well, Jim.
Good to be with you.
So I say, sadly, we have to start with this latest presidential tweet storm. It's hard to avoid this story because it just literally drowns out everything else. But here's what happened, and most people know. He called Brzezinski and Scarborough low IQ, crazy Mika, and psycho Joe, and then went after Brzezinski, saying that on New Year's Eve, she was bleeding badly from a facelift down at Mar-a-Lago. Even Republicans condemned the president this time around. Reactions, gentlemen? John?
Well, I've long ago abandoned any expectation that Donald Trump would show a shred of decency about anything. So to me, this is pretty much business as usual for him. I mean, you can go into the psychology of it with women. There's something about blood and Trump that is very unsettling. What bothers me the most, though, about this is the people who are applauding Donald Trump, who approve of Donald Trump, because those people aren't term limited, and there's no 25th Amendment for those people. And I think that that is a group that is solid, that
Now, you're talking about his base, or you're talking about lawmakers in Washington?
There's no fellow lawmaker who approves of what Donald Trump said.
Right.
But this is, if you go on social media and you look at the people who are applauding him for going after Mika Brzezinski, that is a really troubling group of people who will not change, who will not go away, and who will support Donald Trump whatever he does. And I think that's the worst part of this story.
Yeah, Jim, what's your reaction to this tweet storm at the end of the week?
It's the Worldwide Wrestling Federation taking over the White House.
I don't know. That's a good way to put it. I think that does an extreme disservice to the Worldwide Wrestling Federation.
I'm not so sure I used to watch that when I was a kid. Unlike Donald Trump, I'll admit to having watched that. And when Mika says he appears to be impetuous and childish, I mean, I think we're past appearances at this point, and I think the mantra is not when we go low, we go really low. It's sort of when we go low, we go really low, and then we stay up. We don't sleep very much. We go even lower.
Well, I want to just hear the response from the White House. So Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked during a press conference yesterday, the press briefing, the daily briefing, if the president went too far with his tweet. She said the president has been attacked mercilessly on that Morning Joe show and other parts of the liberal media. Here's what she said.
And I think he's been very clear that when he gets attacked, he's going to hit back. I think the American people elected somebody who's tough, who's smart, and who's a fighter. And that's Donald Trump. And I don't think that it's a surprise to anybody that he fights fire with fire.
Now, Huckabee's father, the former Arkansas governor, Mike Huckabee, said in a remarkable bit of understatement that Trump's tweets, quote, makes my daughter's job very difficult, which I found interesting. But look, one more question about this, and then we'll move on. It's been pointed out again and again and again that Trump's behavior, these outrageous tweets, play well to his base. But we seem to be reasking the same question again and again and again. How low can he go before something breaks, something gives? What's the answer to that, John?
I've long ago given up any predictions about what Donald Trump might do. I mean, I think he can go as low as his imagination takes him. And I think that there's virtually nothing that's off limits for him. And that's difficult on a number of levels. One is to be dealing with him on any kind of a professional or political level. And two, to be dealing with him as the representative of the United States of America. It's mortifying to have him as the president doing these kinds of things. And I think that doesn't go away either.
Yeah. Jim?
So I think short term, politically, just talk politically for a second, I don't think there is a barrier to how low he goes in the sense that I think the Republicans know that they have to get the health care legislation done. They have to do a few other things, and they'll all coalesce around him until they get that done. I think longer term, you get into the second year, third year, and he's easily expended. They'd much rather see someone like Pence move forward as the next presidential candidate or something. So I think he loses a lot longer term in his party. Beyond that, I agree with John.
Interesting. All right. Well, as we said, and you mentioned the health care bill, and all of this distracts from the important business that Washington is trying to accomplish. So let's move on and talk about that Senate health care bill. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, was unable to get hardline conservatives aboard who want the bill to go further in dismantling Obamacare. And he was unable to get the moderates like Susan Collins of Maine, who we heard from, who worry about deep cuts in Medicare, loss of big dollars to the states and some 22 million more Americans without health insurance, according to the CBO score. So McConnell raised the unimaginable possibility of negotiating with Democrats if he can't get the votes from his own party.
And we'll have to sit down with Senator Schumer, and my suspicion is that any negotiation with the Democrats would include none of the reforms that we would like to make, both on the market side and the Medicaid side.
Jim, I mean, is it possible that, I mean, was that really McConnell sort of waving the stick at fellow Republicans, or might this actually end up with some kind of negotiation with the
Democrats? No, it will not happen.
It will not.
The Speaker Ryan did exactly the same thing. And when I step back and I look at this, look, there's little doubt in my mind the Senate will get a bill. The political dynamics are such they will have to do something. Otherwise, McConnell's own stature is diminished significantly. What will give, I think, is oddly Ted Cruz becomes a compromise or leader of the compromise in saying that, hey, I will we'll all give up on the net investment tax cut and the extra Medicare tax that was put into place with the Affordable Care Act. Now, that gives him all kinds of room to address what is, and I would argue that the CBO score is not representative of reality, but it's probably more between 2 million and 8 million. It's hard to understand. People would lose insurance. That's still a losing card, by the way.
Yeah.
But they will, with tax subsidies, tax credits and subsidies, be able to make a large dent in that, especially if they don't get rid of that tax rate. And they will do whatever they have to do to get this through. So this is just a feint of the head. He is not going there.
What do you think, John? Just a feint?
I think it's the nuclear option. He's just, you know, shaking a stick at them. But yeah, let me give some numbers here so that we know, because there are parallel information universes existing out there. You know, the narrative that the Republicans are putting out is drastically different from the narrative that the Democrats are putting out. But here's what the CBO says. A 64-year-old who makes $26,500 a year, his premiums will go from $1,700 a year to $6,500 a year. His deductible will go from $3,500 to $6,000. That's a potential for spending $12,500 on health insurance. That person is not going to have health insurance. A fast food worker who makes $15,000, he can get a tax credit all he wants from the government. He's still going to have to pay $300 to $400 a month, and he's taking home $1,200 a month. So the math just doesn't work. And this whole idea of Paul Ryan's that 22 million people are going to choose not to have health insurance, I mean, it completely discounts the 15 million people who could lose Medicaid, not to mention the ripple effect of that. So to me, if they get this bill through, this will be a disastrous bill. And this will be a bill that will boomerang on them in a major way, because there's a lot of people out there who are accepting the Republicans' narrative who, when this comes down, this is going to come crashing down on them in a serious financial way, and they're going to know that they picked the wrong narrative.
And Jim, what about the potentially disastrous consequences for the Republicans if this bill goes through? I mean, we were looking at an NPR PBS Marist poll this week that showed at least the bill, as Americans understand it today, has something like 17% support.
Right. And if you look at it, I think the Republicans, there are 53% of the Republicans who believe that the Republicans should go further and undo the Affordable Care Act. On the other side, you have Democrats who are saying, look, you can do more with it. And I think Americans are fundamentally divided on it. I would say it would be really helpful to have Democrats and Republicans together on this. I don't think it's going to happen. It didn't happen in 2010. It was all D's.
Yep.
And then now it's all R's. In a dysfunctional way, I think the American system's kind of working. I know that's an anomalous view, but a lot of the Affordable Care Act will remain in this. The Medicaid reforms or cuts, however you want to put it, it's based on a capitated model that Bill Clinton used to support. He said this is the way forward for us. I would just note one thing for Massachusetts. We were 97% insured in 2011. 1.3 million people are on Medicaid. We are 97% insured right now after the Affordable Care Act changed what we were doing. And 1.95 million people are on Medicaid. 44% of our state budget goes to Medicaid, almost 60% of our state budget.
So something has to be done.
Something has to give,
yeah,
unless we want to cut everything.
Yeah, interesting.
Well, the cuts are going to come if the bill actually shifts to a block granting of Medicaid money. And the cuts are either going to come in the services that Medicaid provides, or it's going to be an increased burden on the Massachusetts taxpayer. Let me just say one thing about the 17% approval rating. It is not true, as some have alleged, that the Senate health care bill is less popular than head lice. it is more popular than head lice, but
glad we clarified.
Yeah, but just barely.
Okay, I have one more question about this, and for obvious reasons, we're focusing on the Republican plan. They have the majority there; that's where the action is. But what about? I mean, there are clearly problems with Obamacare. I mean, I'll just name one. If you're low to middle income, your premiums did go up. It's a big problem for a lot of folks. I'm not hearing any Democrats in this debate saying, okay, Obamacare, we've got some problems. Here's how we would fix it. Now, not that that would necessarily be received by Mitch McConnell at this point, but wouldn't it give them a little more credibility in their opposition if they expressed some seriousness about how to fix Obamacare?
Look, I would just say that if politics is the land of hypocrisy, healthcare politics is way beyond that. And what I'd say is, I mean, seriously, if you go back to 2010 everyone who understood anything about Romney Care here could understand that if you're looking at the chassis of a car and said Romney Care designed it, the chassis of Obamacare was, there were a lot of similarities there, and Republicans walked away from that, and Democrats are walking away from a whole bunch of stuff here too. They all do it. We're all playing team sports, and it's kind of tiresome.
I agree with that. All right, let's move on. To talk about the partial travel ban. Parts of President Trump's travel ban went into effect last night following this week's ruling by the Supreme Court, which agreed to take up the travel ban, the challenge to the travel ban, in the fall. In the meantime, the ruling means that travelers from six mostly Muslim countries can't enter the U.S. unless they have bona fide relationships with people or entities in the U.S. The Trump White House called this a legal victory. Here's Press Secretary Sean Spicer the day of the ruling.
The president was honored by the 9-0 decision that allows him to use an important tool to protect our nation's homeland.
Now, advocates for immigrants, interestingly, say the decision was a win for them. Here's Susan Church, chair of the New England chapter of the American Immigration Lawyers Association.
I actually feel very strongly that it's a victory, and I had a lot of sleepless nights over what the Supreme Court could have done. I think it was a victory because it established the right of some people to come here.
So who won here? I mean, you hear both sides claiming victory here. John, what do you think?
Well, this is another situation where you've got parallel information universes. I think that there's a little truth in both of those sides. But I think that the battle is not over yet, because Hawaii has just filed suit saying essentially the way the Trump administration has set this up is more restrictive than what the Supreme Court intended. The Supreme Court wanted to lift the court injunction with respect to foreign nationals abroad who have no connection to the United States at all. And then you wonder, so why are grandparents?
Grandparents, grandchildren's, aunts, uncles.
Right. And it's interesting. The in-laws get in, but the grandparents don't, which I think is a little punitive. But regardless of that, this is taking a list from the Immigration and Nationality Act on who is connected to the U.S. and using that in the most restrictive way, instead of using it the way that it has been used and the way it was set up, which is to prioritize connections, not to decide or define connections. So I think that, you know, there may be changes coming along here, because I think that that the Trump administration is overreaching at this point.
Now, it's interesting because you mentioned legal challenges from Hawaii. The Hawaii Attorney General Doug Chin has filed a motion to clarify the definition of what is meant by close family, saying that the current definition could be a violation of the Supreme Court ruling. Here's Attorney General Chin.
There's no question, you know, that what has happened has created a chilling effect. It's created uncertainty in the United States.
So what's interesting about this, Jim, is the dissent to the Supreme Court decision was written by Justice Clarence Thomas, joined by Samuel Alito and Neil Gorsuch, and they argued the court should have allowed the entire travel ban to go into effect while they consider the case, saying that the compromise will invite a flood of litigation until this case is finally resolved on the merits. And it looks like we're beginning to see some of that litigation. Right?
I think that's exactly right. When it came out, I mean, one of the first thoughts that went through my mind was this is just teeing up a whole bunch of lawsuits. I mean, there are a number of issues around this. And truth be told, look, I went through this with my ex, nice woman that she is. It's when we got married. It's so arbitrary, whatever you do on immigration, right? And it is arbitrary in the consular offices. It's arbitrary in terms of how people interpret guidance from the State Department. And I think we're in for probably more stasis. This order will get stopped, I think, by the time August gets in. We don't know how long it'll last. And it's just a bunch of confusion over an issue that, frankly, is not it's not worth all this time.
But it's can I just add, it's also,
yeah, please, John.
It's rigged, because you look at the refugee situation, and the Trump administration is barring refugees who have a relationship with refugee resettlement organizations, which is virtually every refugee. So unless a refugee has a parent or a child or whoever is on the in list, unless the refugee has that here in the United States, they can't get in either. And that is also excessively restrictive in the eyes of some people. So the way this has been set up is not necessarily the way the Supreme Court intended it Clarence Thomas's dissent notwithstanding. So I think that the problem is 90 days is a blink of an eye in terms of legal time. So I think a lot of this is not going to get settled before the effects are felt.
Well, boy, this legal tangle began the moment the first version of the travel ban was announced, and it doesn't seem like the legal tangle is going to be untangled anytime soon. So I'm sure we're going to be talking about this more in the weeks and months ahead. Let's move on. I want to talk about the case of Sonia Farrick. She's a crime lab chemist. She was in Western Massachusetts, who pleaded guilty in 2014 to stealing drugs and tampering with evidence. Now, on Monday, Hamden Superior Court Judge Richard Carey vacated several of the cases she was connected to, citing prosecutorial misconduct by two former assistant attorneys general. The judge said the prosecutors deliberately withheld evidence about Farrick's drug use, which had a direct bearing on the cases. So here's Northampton defense attorney Luke Ryan, who we spoke to earlier this week on Radio Boston, and he played a key role in bringing this evidence to light.
It's this moral hazard that exists for prosecutors who are more interested in winning a conviction than serving justice. So this case, I think, illustrates this fear that many of us in this system have as to the things that can happen.
And here's Jared Olenoff. He's a Springfield lawyer who represented one of the defendants whose case was dismissed by this decision.
To find out now, that years later, that they were hidden from me is a really low-down, dirty thing that you don't see too often in this practice. But when you do, it's harmful. It's harmful to everybody. It's harmful to the system as a whole.
Now, what he was referring to as what was hidden from him was evidence of Farrick's drug use, essentially. So, thoughts. Attorneys say there are potentially thousands of cases that could be jeopardized by this scandal. What do you see in this story, Jim?
Well, you know, whenever I'm on the internet and I see a really crazy story, I always end up finding out it's from Florida. And when I see crazy stories about crime labs, it ends up being in Massachusetts for some reason.
Yeah.
This is something that will actually impact possibly, say, up to 18,000 cases. What is probably even more astounding is that Luke Ryan, the defense lawyer for one of the people that was charged on the basis of evidence that was brought, that was analyzed by Sonia Farrick, had the wherewithal or the stick-to-itiveness to actually keep on this. And I think he's done amazing work. I mean, he's actually found, look, we all know the awesome power of prosecutors, and they have an obligation at the end of the day to turn over even evidence that could be exculpatory. Do we always believe they do that? Do lawyers actually stick to it that long to do it? I think he's done a real service for justice. I hope that a lot of people who are involved in those 18,000 cases, if they're innocent, they get off. And if they're guilty, somehow you find a way to make sure they pay the price for their...
You mentioned Luke Ryan, the defense attorney from Northampton. We were talking to David Boeri and Luke Ryan and our senior reporter, David Boeri, earlier this week. And Boeri described Ryan as nothing short of heroic. I mean, the work that he did to sort of unearth this miscarriage, this apparent miscarriage of justice. John, what do you see here?
Well, what I see is a lot of a focus on individuals here, on Annie Ducan, on Sonia Farrick, on even the two assistant AGs who were involved in this case. What I don't see is a lot of focus on the administrative issue here. I mean, this is a complete bureaucratic meltdown in two separate crime labs in Massachusetts. And I think that that two things really need to happen here. One is that there should be some kind of a review and some kind of increased oversight in these crime labs so that these kinds of things become less common than they are now. And I think Attorney General Maura Healey needs to step forward. I don't understand why she needs to take a step back and take time to review this. You know, this has all been out there for 2 years now.
Yeah.
So I think that she's sort of ducking and hiding at this point, not to her credit by any means. And I think she needs to step up and take responsibility for what happened and to somehow give the public some kind of confidence that this will be addressed in some serious way.
So I want to talk just really quickly about the two assistant attorneys general. Chris Foster and Ann Kaczmarek worked under former Attorney General Martha Coakley. Kaczmarek has issued a statement saying she disagrees with the characterization of her conduct. What's interesting is they're both still working in state government. Kim Foster is general counsel of the state's Alcoholic Beverages Control Commission. Kaz Marek is an assistant clerk magistrate in Suffolk County. Should they still have their jobs, given what we know? What do you think, gentlemen?
I would say not. I would say that the ethical lapse is large enough that you'd have to, they have to pay some sort of price.
Yeah. Yeah, you would hope. You would hope that there'd be some repercussions, and maybe when this all gets sorted out, finally, there will be.
But John, great point. I mean, about this system-wide issue as opposed to sort of focusing on individuals. It's a great point, and we've seen, maybe it's wrong to use the word systematic, but there are problems in the criminal justice system that suggest systematic reform is necessary, and this might be an example of such. Yeah. Well, let's move on to our hubbubs, those brief stories that might not have made headlines but caught the attention of our panelists. John, let's go to you first.
My hubbub comes from a Wall Street Journal A-head this week. The A-heads are those stories at the bottom of page one, the sort of offbeat, quirky stories. And it starts with a woman in Maine named Yvette Meunier, who on her daily bike ride noticed all these little bottles on the road. And so she decided to chronicle them. And so basically she did a census of discarded little bottles and came up with this: 9.4 mini liquor bottles, 2.3 energy drinks, and 1.25 milk containers per mile. Wow. On her 8-mile drive. So she put them all in a bag, took them to the legislature. They passed a law putting a 5-cent deposit on mini liquor bottles. The governor, Paul LePage, vetoed it. They overrode his veto. Now, here in Massachusetts, there is the same law being proposed. So Randy Hunt, state rep from Sandwich, has put forward House Bill H3528, which is an act promoting the proper disposal of miniatures. There is a petition out there called Nip the Nips. It has 1,314 or 41 signatures on it at this point. So keep an eye out. There's been one hearing. We'll see if a 5-cent NIP deposits actually come to fruition in Massachusetts.
I like that. Nip the nips. All right. Top that, Jim Sturgis.
Well, mine's an only in Boston story. You know, we Americans have been subjected to every matter of humiliation by the TSA. Our shoes come off, our jackets and belts, put them on a tray, remove our computers, telephones, cameras, bottle throw it away. They touch us sometimes in funny places. It's unbecoming to a free people to subject ourselves to this. But Boston, the cradle of liberty, can only take so much. And there is what happened recently was a goateed TSA tyrant crossed the line and decided to paw Dinah, a 20-pound lobster that was purchased by a Savannah, Georgia repairman who was on vacation here. And the TSA fella dared take a selfie with his lobster. Much, much protest to that. So.
That's great. A great story. All right. So my hubbub is about the great Red Sox pitcher turned conservative pundit. Some people might say the not so great conservative pundit. Others might say great. Anyway, Curt Schilling. If you're curious about him, check out the profile in the current issue of Esquire by Timothy Bella. It just came out. It's great reading. If you don't know already, Schilling is now host of Whatever It Takes, a 2-hour morning show for Breitbart News, the right-wing news organization formerly run by the Trump chief strategist Steve Bannon. In the profile, you can read about how Schilling has suggested that Muslim extremists pose a threat comparable to Nazis, that Hillary Clinton should be buried under a jail somewhere, and that blacks should stop complaining about slavery. Stunning. Best quote in the piece comes from Schilling himself, quote, "Given how much I talk, it's amazing that I haven't ruined myself," unquote. But why should we care about this guy? I mean, he is considering seriously running for Senate against Elizabeth Warren next year. It's easy to dismiss that ambition as absurd, especially in true blue Massachusetts. Then again, Schilling reminds us that we live in a time of unlikely political upsets. So it's an article worth reading.
And they say there are no screwballs in baseball anymore.
Okay. Well timed, John. John, you completely threw me off my game with that great comment. John Carroll, BU Professor of Communication and News Analyst for WBUR, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And Jim Sturgis of the Pioneer Institute, thank you. Have a great weekend.
Happy 4th.
Happy 4th to both of you. Stay with us. Coming up, where the recreational marijuana bill currently stands on Beacon Hill. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. On Beacon Hill, House and Senate lawmakers are trying to agree on how to change the state's voter-approved law, which legalized marijuana for recreational use. And they're having a tough time getting together on this. WBUR's Steve Brown is at the State House with the latest on this. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks, Anthony.
So it sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, the Senate wants to basically stick with the law as approved by voters, but tweak it. But the House really wants to make much bigger changes. And one of the big sticking points is taxes. Can you tell us what's going on here?
Well, as far as taxes are concerned, and you are right, the Senate wants to tread lightly on that referendum that nearly 1.8 million Massachusetts voters last November approved, legalizing recreational or adult-use marijuana here in Massachusetts. The Senate has had sort of a tread lightly approach, make a few tweaks here, changes there, whereas the House has been far more aggressive. And one of the things that the House bill does is actually repeals that whole thing that we passed last November. Just says throw it out. You mentioned taxes. Yes, taxes is one of the areas that there's big differences there. The Senate is sticking with the 12%, which is already in the law as it stands right now. The House wanted a lot more. They're going at 28%. Now, some are saying that maybe that's an old negotiating tactic. If you've ever tried to negotiate a salary, you don't go in saying what you actually want. You shoot a little bit higher. As a matter of fact, during the House debate, Mark Cusack, the chairman, said it's better to aim high now, and then you can always lower that tax later. So that's the feeling right now, is that they've gone with that 28% figure, with the fact that they might be able to negotiate it down. The Senate, though, really doesn't have to do anything. The law is already, the tax rate is already at the rate that the Senate says they want it to be.
Right. Now, another big difference has to do with local input. And here we're talking about whether towns and cities can hold a referendum on whether to ban recreational marijuana businesses, or whether municipal leaders should be the ones to decide that. And that's what the House wants to do, right?
That's right, and like the tax issue, the Senate's still in the same catbird seat here. They don't have to do anything. Their position is to keep it as the law it was passed by the voters last November. Don't do anything. Just allow the system to work as it is. And the way it is, it's a little bit confusing. And that's what some of the communities have been coming up here and saying, hey, you got to clarify this. We don't know whether we got to go to town meeting first or our appeals board first. They haven't quite figured out that. But ultimately, it comes down that a referendum in that city or town has to be put before the voters before they can say no to a marijuana business.
Right. Steve, it seems like the larger conflict here is about, you know, that vote that we mentioned, the will of the voters. What are lawmakers in the House saying about making changes to a law? I mean, as you said, throwing the whole thing out, that over 53% of voters approved.
I'm sensing a little bit of a disconnect between the House leadership and some of the members of the House. Everybody says, "Oh, we are going to respect the will of the voters, no matter what." Whenever you ask them that's the first thing right out of their mouths. But I think some of the rank and file feel that maybe they've gone a little bit too far. They haven't said a whole lot right now because it is in conference. And when two bills go into the conference committee, it's up to six legislators, three senators, three representatives, to iron out the differences. So again, they're saying we want to respect the will of the people. But then again, you look at the House vote and it says the will of the people from last November, we're throwing that out. We're starting from square one.
Yeah. So they're in conference now. I understand that they wanted to get a bill to the governor today. Is that even possible?
Nope.
In a word,
how's that?
No.
Nope.
Yeah, no. That's
nope.
That's what
no,
I'm looking for. A clear
that
answer.
Ship has sailed. That ship has sailed.
So what are we looking at? Is there a deadline? What's going to happen?
Well, this was a self-imposed deadline. The feeling was a year from tomorrow is supposed to be the day that retail marijuana sales, the stores, the dispensaries are supposed to open up to the public a year from tomorrow. And so the feeling was we need to have a year to get this Cannabis Control Commission in place, a board to govern the new industry, and that would be enough time. So, you know, they missed their deadline. They don't like to do that. They like to say, hey, see, we said we were going to do this, and we did. If they come back on Wednesday or Thursday of next week, which it's beginning to look more and more like that's what they might wind up doing, it's not going to make a whole lot of difference. There's already a law on the books. The voters approved it last November.
All right. Well, there's the latest on legalized recreational pot use in Massachusetts from WBUR State House reporter Steve Brown. Steve, thanks so much for bringing us up to date.
Thank you, Anthony.
And let's move on to another New England legislative battle, this one over taxes. Maine Governor Paul LePage says he will shut down the government today unless lawmakers in his state can agree on a two-year budget that does not include new taxes. And LePage says he's serious and he's mad. Here he is on WAGN Radio this week.
I've been talking to these people for 6 months. They've ignored. They're playing games. They're playing chicken at 100 miles an hour. And I'll tell you something. You want to play chicken? Let's play chicken.
All right. There's Governor LePage joining us now from Augusta, Maine, is Mal Leary. He's political correspondent for Maine Public Radio. Mal, thanks for joining us.
Afternoon.
So tell me a little bit about this standoff. How did we get to this point?
Well, it's interesting, given the story you just had on the air about the Citizens Initiative down in Massachusetts. It was a Citizens Initiative that caused all of this. Sponsored mostly by the State Teachers Association, they put on the ballot and the voters approved a 3% surcharge on incomes over $200,000 a year to raise additional money for schools in the state. That would have brought in about $320 million. That is mostly aimed at high earners and small businesses who pay their taxes through their individual income taxes. Republicans are having none of that. From the get-go, Republicans have said that's got to be repealed. We cannot have this high tax. We're the second highest top tax rate in the country for personal income. We got to get rid of this thing, and how do we do it? Well, that's been the battle that's been going on, the governor is talking about, for months now. And what final compromise that is going before the legislature this afternoon is there's a slight increase in the lodgings tax as part of this budget put together to put additional money forward for education while repealing what the voters approved last November, that surtax. And the governor is adamant, as he has been throughout his time as governor, that he will not go for any tax increase unless it's to lower another tax.
I see.
And the way he's looking at this, that's not what's happening.
All right, let's listen a little bit more to Governor LePage. Here he is earlier this week again on WGAN, and he's making it pretty clear what he'll do if he doesn't get what he's demanding.
I will tell you this. If they put a tax increase, ready for a shutdown. Mm. End of story. I've told them since January, you increase taxes without lowering the income tax, I will take my 10 days.
So, Matt, when he says, I will take my 10 days, that's the constitutional 10 days he has to sign a budget, right? And if he doesn't sign it, then the budget's dead, essentially.
Yeah, but it's 10 days in which he can sign it, veto it, or let it become law without his signature.
Yeah.
He's made it very clear today in a news conference that was called on 5 minutes' notice that he's going to veto the budget, but he's going to take the whole 10 days to do it, forcing a shutdown because he says the legislature is abandoning its responsibility to give him a budget that he can sign.
I see.
So that's where we're at.
I see. So let's assume the partial shutdown goes into effect. What happens? What remains? What's shut down and what remains open in the state of Maine?
We went through one of these several years ago, 1991, so we sort of have a template of what's going to happen, and the governor's already announced he's going to use his emergency powers to order the state police, to order workers at the psychiatric hospital, at the prison system, to continue to work. The courts will be open, a few of the courts will be open part of the time during the shutdown, so there's some access to the courts, but a lot of the normal activities will not occur until the shutdown is ended. in essence, it's what's called essential workers, which
right.
the governor determines under his emergency powers. And it's varied. For example, he says state parks are essential, that he have rangers there to prevent vandalism. So they're going to be open, even though they weren't 26 years ago, the last time we had a shutdown.
I see. And now, if the government is shut down, so what are the biggest concerns? I mean, I've read, for example, that low-income residents are concerned about state benefits, such as food and cash assistance being interrupted. Is that, in fact, a possibility?
That's not going to happen. The advocates for those folks were about to go to federal court this afternoon when the state agreed to say we're going to make those payments. Most of the money for those payments, two-thirds of it, is federal money anyway. So that's kind of off the table at the moment. The biggest group affected here are those state workers who are not considered essential. That's around 10,000 is what I'm told. They're going to be out of work, and they're not going to get paid. And they don't know when they will go back to work until the shutdown is resolved. So those are the folks that are most directly affected. Average Maine citizens, they're not going to be able to go to the Bureau of Motor Vehicles and register their car or get their license. Those sort of state services will be disrupted.
It's
a partial shutdown, not a total shutdown.
Got it. One more question, Mal, and this sort of gets to how LePage's position is playing across the state of Maine. I mean, if I'm understanding this correctly, legislators came together, they sort of compromised, but Governor LePage is being pretty hard line here. How is his position playing with voters across Maine? Do we have any idea of that?
We don't have any sort of polling data on that, but I can tell you that what you have to remember is, like any legislative body, there are really four caucuses. And right now you've got the Senate Democrats and the House Democrats and the Senate Republicans on the same page. It's House Republicans who are supporting the governor. Most of them are supporting the governor. And that's where the budget could fail.
I see.
Is that they get enough votes, they can sustain a governor's veto. So that's the issue that's swirling, is how many House Republicans will stick with the governor and how many will not.
All right. That's Mal Leary. He's political correspondent for Maine Public Radio, talking about what could be a government shutdown in the state of Maine by the end of the day today. Mal, thanks so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, the history of the famous Fourth of July tradition. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Fourth of July weekend is finally here, so we want to turn now to WBUR meteorologist David Epstein for a look at the holiday weekend forecast. David, give us good news. What do you see out there?
All right. Well, first, Anthony, we have a severe thunderstorm watch up until 9 o'clock tonight from Worcester County westward. That includes southern New Hampshire and northern portions of Connecticut. So there could be showers and thunderstorms, some strong here up through the evening hours as they get to the coastline in Boston. Just look for sort of run-of-the-mill summertime thunderstorms. Tomorrow is kind of a summertime day, a blend of clouds and sunshine, maybe some pop-up storms in the afternoon and evening. I would not cancel any plans, even with showers in the forecast. Really warm, really humid, 85 to 90. The showers move out Sunday, and right now I'm more optimistic for Sunday than I was even 12 hours ago. I think the front's moving fast enough. We clear out, maybe a pop-up isolated storm Sunday afternoon, but a really nice day. Sunshine around, temperatures 85 to 90. Humidity goes down Monday and Tuesday. Plenty of sunshine both days. That includes northern New England, and temperatures in the low to mid-80s. So all in all, I think it's a really nice four-day stretch of weather, save for the scattered showers and thunderstorms we have this evening and again tomorrow.
It sounds great. So the conditions for the fireworks on Tuesday, the 4th of July, sound like they'll be pretty good.
Yeah, no problems at all. Fireworks Sunday, Monday, or Tuesday, because different towns have them at different times.
All right. That's WBUR meteorologist David Epstein. David, have a great weekend and happy 4th of July. Thanks for joining us.
Right back at you.
All right. As we said, for many, today is the start of the 4th of July summer holiday. So before we go, we wanted to offer an appreciation of an Independence Day tradition. The This, of course, is the Boston Pops performing Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture, the jubilant climax to every 4th of July celebration on Boston's Esplanade. But when you think about it, it's a bit strange that music commemorating Napoleon's retreat from Russia has become synonymous with American independence. So a couple of years back, my colleague and Radio Boston host Meghna Chakrabarty wanted to find out why.
Well, to find out the answer, we are going straight to the source. Keith Lockhart, conductor of the Boston Pops for the past 20 years. He joins us now. And Keith Lockhart, thank you so much. I know you've got a lot to do to prepare for Saturday night's concert, but we appreciate your time.
Well, we do have a few things going on right now, but it's great to talk to you guys, and happy 4th.
Happy 4th to you. Okay, so the Pops have been performing the 1812 Overture since 1974 with the fireworks. But Maestro Lockhart, we are in the cradle of independence. Shouldn't the music be more 1776 rather than 1812? How did this happen?
It's funny, actually. We have created a tradition that has really spread around this country. I mean, we're not the only people who perform the 1812 Overture on Independence Day these days. It dates back to 74, and I wasn't around here yet at that point. But my understanding of the situation was that local businessman David Mugar was talking to Arthur Fiedler about a brand new concept to have a huge celebratory concert on the Esplanade complete with fireworks. And he wanted a finale for the concert, and he said to Arthur, he said, what's that piece that has all the cannons and bells at the end of it? And Fiedler said, well, that's the 1812 Overture. And Mugar apparently said, I want that one. So as a result, and it took. Everybody went crazy about it. Everybody, I think, assumed that it had something to do with the American War of 1812. As you know, it has to do with a completely different war of 1812 right. On the other side of the world. But, you know, the piece contains Tsarist hymns and La Marseillaise to show the retreating French. but outside of that, it's perfectly apt. I have to say, you know, traditions are what you make of them, and this is a country of assimilation, and we've assimilated the history and culture of a completely different country and made it our own.
Oh, so in a very American tradition, as you're saying. I mean, I believe I heard that Arthur Fiedler, when he heard David Mugar's suggestion, he smiled and said, sounds great, just let all hell break loose at the end.
Well, that's pretty much what that piece does. And obviously, the sense of space and location out on the Esplanade, being able to ring the church bells in the vicinity and having the cannons booming over the Charles, really makes a lot of sense. It's a great ending. It's a great celebratory ending. And I think at this point, the origins of the piece have less to do with it than the impact it has on audiences today.
Now, why do you think other orchestras around the country followed the Pops' lead after those first couple performances in 74, 75, 76?
Well, I think people heard it around the country on the Bicentennial Concert in 1976.
Of course.
And frankly, I think everybody thought it was a really good idea.
Because, I mean, the music is very jubilant. It's very celebratory. Can you tell me what it's like for you standing before the Pops, guiding the orchestra through this as the fireworks are going off?
Well, it's very exciting. To tell you the truth, we can't see the fireworks. The fireworks happen behind the hat shell, so which is just as good because we have enough distractions as it is. But it is very exciting because it is kind of the 11th hour moment of the concert, and things are really winding up, and you can sense the anticipation of the audience. They clap at the point that they know that the cannons are going to come in soon, and you know, everybody is geared up for a good time, and we're just happy to be giving it to them. It's a tradition that really doesn't get old.
And what do you love about the piece musically?
I think my favorite part of the piece musically is the opening, which is very beautiful, a setting for basically the violas and the cellos of a hymn from the Russian Orthodox tradition that asked God to protect and look over the royal family, which, as I said, makes it even more incongruous if you know that, but it's very beautiful.
Before I let you go, though, you know, I still am in my mind wrestling with the incongruity of the 1812 Overture and the 4th of July. Do you think you ever might have, I don't know, the chutzpah to suggest that the Pops do something different?
I would never be the first one to suggest that. I can give you an address and you can mail your suggestion.
Well, I won't be the one to mess with tradition, as incongruous as it might be. Keith Lockhart is the longtime conductor of the Boston Pops Orchestra, 20 years as maestro. Mr. Lockhart, thank you so very much, and good luck on Saturday night.
My pleasure. Thanks so much. Bye now.
Magna Chakrabarty there talking to Keith Lockhart a couple of years ago. And as usual, you can catch the Boston Pop Fireworks Spectacular with Keith Lockhart Tuesday evening, July 4th on the Esplanade. And that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR Boston, NPR's Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Bruzek, with help from Caitlin O'Keefe, Sean Bowden, and Eric Mangrum. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Anthony Brooks, and if you're celebrating on the Esplanade, at the beach, or in your own backyard, be safe, have a great weekend, and a great holiday. This is Radio Boston.